Listen, everyone makes messes. It's just a part of life. And the bigger you live, the bigger the mess, if you know what I mean. That's why you need Fabuloso. With twice the active cleaning ingredients, it just completely takes the drama out of any mess. It smells great while you clean. The only way to describe it is the scent of passion. And once you're done cleaning, it lasts so long. You know, if you make a mess, you can get your home dramatically clean with Fabuloso. No worries.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes see details.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
What's shaking my gravity peeps? This is Matt Tebbe. You're listening to the Gravity Commons Podcast. I'm joined by Benjamin Sternke and Christy Penley. Good day to you too.
Hey, everybody. Good day.
We are
Christy. What's your full name? Matt pronounced my full Benjamin. What are you? Christina?
No, I'm Christine.
Christine. Okay.
Yep. Christine. Very nice. And Lynn.
Christine Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew Jacob, if I remember correctly.
That's it.
MJ.
Does anybody know my middle name? I know we've talked about this in the podcast.
We've talked about this.
No, I know it.
Tell us, Matthew.
Oh, it's Eric. Benjamin Eric. So sorry.
I didn't even get a chance to say anything.
Oh, sorry, man. Did I steal your thunder? Was that what you were thinking?
Ben was preempting me saying some nonsense.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Maybe I was like, subconsciously doing
let's
that.
Let's just shortcut the nonsense and let me just get our Eric this. Out there. Yeah.
That maybe is what I was doing. Anyway.
Hey, so this is coming to you a week after Election Day. I know we put out a little podcast where I was chatting with some friends, kind of impromptu, off the cuff, informal convo about the challenges that the election and politics in our churches and our families and our Thanksgivings they present for us. How are you two doing? What's shaking? You guys weren't on that combo. I'm checking in with my friends here. Christy, how are you?
I wasn't on that combo because I'm on day three of snow days here, people. We are snowed in Colorado.
Wow.
I have lots of mixed emotions, and honestly, I didn't have a lot of words the first little bit. People reached out to me and I just wasn't ready to engage because I wasn't sure I could do it with grace and truth, to be honest. Mm-hmm. So I stayed silent for a while. Ben, what was your response?
Yeah, it was interesting. I felt sort of a sickening deja vu from 8 years ago. But it felt a little different. I think 8 years ago, I was like really shocked and really like, just, you know,
like blindsided almost.
Yeah. Just like it took 8 years to go like, what in the world? Like what? Literally what in the world? Right. But I feel like I know a lot more about what in the world, you know, is like happening in our country and just, you know, a lot more history and understanding about sort of, you know, how this happened and, you know, a bit of a shattering of maybe some myths about America that still were bouncing around in my bones, you know? So I don't know. I definitely felt, you know, I felt like, oh, this is a disaster. and I felt sad, about that. And, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, really, you know? And so, but I also, I felt very sad, but I also, I felt this other, I guess, kind of like a resolve to be like, okay, well, like in some ways, like this doesn't really change anything about what it means to be the church and how we're going to, but it does change, I think, the calculus for me of like, what's it going to cost to be faithful? So I have no idea, but I felt a sense of resolve to be like, okay, well, we're going to process our feelings about this and seek to lead well in our churches around this. But it, I don't know. I don't have much more than that right now. Just a resolve to do the work of organizing to create and sustain, you know, changes and goodness for especially our marginalized neighbors.
Yeah.
We're going to figure that out and we're going to do it.
I'm glad you said that, because I think I need to hear that, because I think that was one of the reasons I was so quiet. Was the next day someone I care deeply about put something very, very racist on social media, and it literally took my breath away. Like I immediately started crying at what they posted and was like, I don't know how to like, what does it look like to love well in this? I don't know. And so it's good to hear that of like, I think in some ways you think, oh, the election's over, and so all of that's going to be done, except for that the next morning I woke up and it was like right in my face, right? Like it was not. Yeah. And so there's one side of me that's like, yes, what does it look like to walk in that and to love well? And then the other side is, okay, what does it look like just to think about pumpkins and Thanksgiving and like moving like in real life? Like this is not declaring what my life is right now. Does that make sense? I don't know how to explain that, but.
Yeah. I think, you know, I've been thinking about this too, Christy. I think there is a tension between, because I feel this in me, we're not accustomed as white, I'm saying this as white people, we're not accustomed to having to sort of reckon with these kind of nebulous, you know, threats or, you know, that kind of thing. We're not accustomed to it. And so our bodies aren't used to it. And so I think there is a temptation. I think there's like a temptation to escape into things that feel comfortable.
Yeah.
That is an evacuation of the space we need to hold. But there's also, and I hear this in what you're describing as well, Christy, there's also a way in which I think part of our resistance can be a refusal to allow the 24/7 news cycle to dominate our lives.
That's right.
You know what I mean? Like there is like, we have to actually create and build something on the ground, which is just like really normal, mundane work. It's like inviting people over. It's having conversations. It's eating with one another. It's caring for one another. Like all of these things happen iteratively and just like very slowly, and they happen very quietly. And I think there's a tension that I feel like we need to address and deal with all the feelings that we're having about this, because we're all connected. To this election and the news cycle and all that kind of thing. It's impossible to avoid the media noise about it. So we have to process those feelings about it. But I do think there's a way in which mammon and, you know, the forces that be can actually win if all we think about now is like this hyper-vigilant, like, you know what I mean? Like we've gotta resist and all that kind of thing. I think part of the way that we resist is we go about creating the new thing that we want to see, you know, in the places where we actually have some influence.
Well, it's interesting because just this week I had a speaking engagement, and this is, I think, honestly, Holy Spirit working in my life. I'm just, this is share time from Christy. but you know, that person like put that racist thing on social media, and then I had the speaking engagement and after the speaking engagement, this woman came up to me and she was like, hey, can I give you a suggestion? And I was like, sure, what's up? And she was like, you posted a picture like at the beginning of your speaking thing and it was all white people. And I just really want to encourage you. She was African American. She's like, I really want to encourage you to use different ethnicities in your pictures, even when you're speaking, even if 99.9% of the people in that room are white, you need to think outside the box. Mm-hmm. And you guys, immediately, like, there was shame. Immediately, there was like, doggone it, like, I'm trying. Yeah. And like, and then I was like, no, like, this is good. Like, I need people in my life to teach me, to show me, to open up my eyes. And I was instead wanting to point a finger at this friend that put something on social media rather than look inside my own heart of like, where else can I grow? Where else can I learn? Yeah. Where else can I love better? You know?
Yeah.
Anyway, so there's a lot going on. There's a lot going on in the Penley heart right now.
Yeah.
So. That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think this is related to the conversation we're having today with Tom Ord that we recorded a while back. We talked to him about he got sort of his credentials taken away and kicked out of his denomination for being open and affirming. And obviously, that's not news to anybody listening to this podcast. The sort of controversy or debate over LGBTQIA plus inclusion and the white church especially has caused a lot of people to leave churches or join churches or get fired or fire people. And so it's one of those topics that maybe is obviously baked into, I think, the 2024 election, right? So specifically trans people, but all LGBTQ people felt like that election was, you know, really important to them. And many of them are grieving. But in this conversation with Tom, we kind of navigate a little bit about why this is a difference that is hard to abide, you know?
Right.
Like Christy likes Michigan Wolverine football, and I like Notre Dame Fighting Irish football. And they really, like those fans don't like each other, but it's a difference that our friendship abides.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most weeks.
Yeah, I mean, it's like there's like 3 hours every 3 years we can't hang out with each other. No, yeah, but I think that, you know, we're going to have more conversations around how we navigate difference, how we listen, like even in the midst of this post election, I've already seen calls from Christians about listening to each other and learning to overcome our differences and being unified for the sake of the kingdom, and I do want us to press into, is there a unity that is unjust?
Yeah.
Is there a unity that oppresses and harms? Right. You know?
Yeah.
And I think this conversation with Tom is exploring that, you know, as he as he explains why he left his denomination and how he did all that. So,
yeah. I'm eager for those conversations as well, because I do see this as one of the main ways that, like, I don't know, there's like a reflexive kind of coming back to this flattening out of different kinds of differences, if I can put it that way, right? Mm-hmm. Where, and I think your example about college football is great, because it's like, that's a difference that is real. You know what I mean? Like, you guys, you're not pretending to be fans, you know, and you really do care about your team. And sometimes your heart rate gets up and, you know, you feel depressed if they don't play. You know, like, those are real differences, but we understand that that should never prevent us from being friends. You know what
right.
I mean?
Right.
But is every difference that kind of difference? And I think that's the mistake that we often make, is that we assume every difference is that kind of difference. And I think there's different kinds of differences that we have to talk about.
So. Yeah. All right. Well, should we do it?
Let's get into it. Do we want to tell the listeners might not be familiar with who Thomas Ord is, but do you have a little bio you want to read there, Matt?
Listener, why don't you guess? And here we go. Hit it. Play.
Tom would probably be fine with that.
Thomas J. Ord is a theologian, philosopher, and scholar of multidisciplinary studies. He's a best-selling and award-winning author, having written or edited more than 30 books. Academic influence ranks him among the most influential theologians in the 21st century. Ord directs doctoral programs at Northwind Theological Seminary and directs the Center for Open and Relational Theology. He's known for his research and writing on love, open and relational theology, science and religion, evil and power, and the implications of freedom and relationships for transformation. Let's hear more from Tom. Dr. Thomas J. Ord, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, Tom, I appreciate you spending time with us today. You've had a busy summer.
Yeah.
You recently stood trial in the Church of the Nazarene for your position on LGBTQ inclusion in the church. And we're going to, I want to talk all about that. I want to talk about sort of the politics within the Nazarene denomination. I think there's a lot of maybe coherence or things will resonate with in terms of how you experience them handling that. I want to talk about the theology surrounding that. But first, I wonder if you could just give kind of pull back a bit and share with us how you, like your faith journey, how you became a Christian, and maybe some of seminal turning points that led you to where you are today.
Yeah. I grew up in a small farming community. My father was a school teacher. My mother was a kind of an entrepreneur, did all kinds of different things. And we attended faithfully the Othello Church of the Nazarene in Washington State. And that community shaped our lives profoundly. My parents were very involved in church. So was my brother and sister and I. And, you know, I gave my heart to Jesus many times as a young person. And by the time I was in high school, I was known for being a Christian. I took my faith very seriously. Went to college. I was one of those radical people at college who would stop you on the sidewalk with the four spiritual laws and witness to you, or stop you going into a bar or sit next to you on a plane. I was one of those annoying people. Mm-hmm. And then near the end of my college career, I took a course in philosophy of religion and started reading some really smart atheists, agnostics, people from other religious traditions. And that experience of reading really smart people led me to think that I didn't have as strong a grounds as I previously thought for being a Christian or even believing in God at all. Hmm. I remember coming to pick up my fiance, who is now my wife, and turning to her and saying, "I just can't believe in God anymore." Now, for me, this turn to atheism or agnosticism, and I'm not really sure which it was, but it was not an act of rebellion. It wasn't because the church had harmed me, you know, anything like that. It was for intellectual reasons. And I think because of that, I kept at the task or the work of thinking through things intellectually. And eventually came back to thinking it was more plausible than not that God exists. Never am sure. I'm not certain today that God exists, but I think a better case can be made for God's existence than non-existence. And from that point, slowly began to add in my beliefs about God, went to graduate school, got a doctorate, started pastoring, did that for 10 years, was a professor for 20 plus years, now direct a doctoral program in open and relational theology. So there are a few highlights.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I want to punctuate is this season, journeying through this season of not knowing and even declaring that you don't know. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if, like, you know, Paul Ricoeur talks about that second naivete, you know, the journey through doubt and disillusionment. What do you notice about how you believe differently pre-doubt and post-doubt? Is there, I'm not even talking about the content of your belief, but I'm talking about the way that believing works in your life. What do you notice about the differences?
Well, for one thing, I would not say I'm post-doubt. I got plenty of doubts. I think when I was younger, I bought into the claim that you'll hear from many people that the really strong believer is someone who is certain of their beliefs and has got the text in scripture or some sort of testimonial evidence that demands the verdict that God exists and Jesus is the only way, kind of a thing. And on philosophical grounds, my basis for certainty was taken away from me. And that changes the way I think about faith today. I don't seek certainty. I don't have certainty. I don't even think I want certainty, to be honest with you. The people who seem to be certain about their beliefs are oftentimes some of the most dangerous. And so I think there's a proper kind of humility. And it means that at least in theory and oftentimes in actuality, I'm willing to change my mind because better evidence or better arguments comes along, or I have a new experience that changes things. And for some people, that's an uncomfortable position to be in. And I think for me, it was for quite some time. But now it just seems like the most honest position to live.
Yeah. Yeah. As you're talking, I want to maybe bring in this concept or this focus on love that you've cultivated over the several decades at least. And I have a book on my shelf, and I'm sure you've read it. It's called Loving to Know, A Covenant Epistemology by Esther Lightcap Meek. And I haven't read it yet, but it strikes me, I wonder if you could speak a bit to the epistemological crisis of certitude then being replaced by a much more gentle, maybe open-handed gathering around love as what the foundation then goes from certitude to love. Tell us a bit about the significance and importance of that for you.
I think, to put it kind of crassly, it's a shift from wanting to have the right answers to prove that you are correct about your knowledge of God, the world, ethics, whatever, to seeking to make the world a better place, to usher in the kingdom of God, to use biblical language, to promote genuine flourishing, to use philosophical language. And that means that my first impulse is asking questions about enhancing value in myself and others and the planet, and even God, in my view, rather than my first impulse is not, how can I prove that this is the correct answer to your question? I still care about answers to questions. I still care about propositions and doctrines and all that sort of stuff. But those are definitely secondary in my way of thinking. Or maybe here's a better way to put it, Matt. When I was a younger Christian, I was a Christian first who then thought I probably ought to be loving. Today, I'm a lover first who still happens to like Christianity, at least some parts of it. So it's a shift in my priority.
Even identity, it seems.
Yes. Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
We'll be right back. The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show.
Tom, I wonder then, you've written extensively about this in The Uncontrolling Love of God and God Can't, et cetera. And we are planning to invite you back on the podcast to chat more about love specifically, because I think that statement right there, I think will be fairly intriguing and challenging to a lot of our listeners. But for this conversation, I wonder if you could tell us, what role did love play in what seems to be, what I'm assuming is a theological shift for you to come into fully affirming LGBTQ plus people?
Yeah, it played a central role and continues to play a central role in my thinking about queer issues. In the early 1990s, I was a seminary student. And as such, I was required to take a course in religious education. Now, at the time, and still today, but especially at the time, I thought of myself as a philosophical theologian. So I didn't really want to take a class with a bunch of people who were thinking about being children's pastors. But that was, there you have it. You know, I had to take this course. Mm-hmm. And so I liked the professor, fortunately, but a couple other people in the course and I decided for our theological educational curricula, we were going to write curricula on the queer issues. And none of us, you know, had really come to any strong resolution in our minds on this. We wanted to, it was sort of an exploratory kind of adventure, but we knew that it was an important issue. And so we come from the Wesleyan theological tradition, and there's a heuristic called the Wesleyan Quadrilateral that looks at four sources for theological reflection: the Bible, experience, reason, and the tradition. And so we ran the questions of, in those days, we just called it homosexuality, but I'll use the word queer here now. We ran the questions of queer inclusion through these lenses. And that meant, especially when it comes to scripture, that I had to, for the first time, look through the 6 to 8 passages that most people think most directly addresses homosexuality. And as I did that, I realized that there was a whole lot more going on than just reading a passage like Leviticus, a man shall not lie with another man, or Romans, you know, they gave up their natural desires for unnatural ones, etc. There was a lot more going on, and we must bring a lot more to bear of our interpretation of the biblical text. And I could go more into detail there, but just to sort of finish that up, it was moving through that quadrilateral that led me to think, you know, I really think I should be what today we call an affirming person. Mm-hmm. I should believe that queer people can be fully legitimate Christians, engaging in healthy sexual behavior, same-sex sexual behavior, et cetera. And prior to that excursion, that exploration, I didn't have that view.
Yeah. Well, you released a book this summer. The title was My Defense, Responding to Charges That I Fully Affirm LGBTQ plus People, right before the trial in the Church of the Nazarene. And, you know, we'll put a link to this book in the show notes. I wonder if you were to give us the elevator summary of why you shifted, right? Could we hear that? And then tacking onto that, who is this book written for? Like, the title sort of indicated to me I'm writing it for my detractors or for the people accusing me. But then as I read portions of it, it seemed like that wasn't the audience as much as others. So I'm curious as to who you wrote it for as well.
Yeah, the elevator speech for that book is that I am convinced Christians should be fully queer affirming, by which I mean they should endorse, embrace queer orientations, queer desires, queer healthy sexual behaviors. And that is an act of love. As I see it, love is about promoting what is good, promotes well-being, flourishing. And I'm convinced, both from science and my own particular interactions with queer people, that queer people can be healthy as queer people. Hmm. The book, well, maybe I should tell you the story of how the book came about. Yeah. Maybe that'll help you with the audience. I was given 2 charges in the summer of 2023 by what we call in my denomination, my district superintendent. One charge was that I was teaching doctrines contrary to the denomination's view of human sexuality, and that was definitely true. And the second one is that I was engaging in conduct unbecoming of a minister for my actions to try to get the denomination to become fully inclusive. And those kinds of actions include coming on podcasts like this, you know, ones like this, or my daughter and I published a massive book of essays that were pro-affirming by Nazarene people. We did an online conference. You know, I was trying to move the people, not just me, but others with me, trying to move the denomination toward a fully affirming position. So those two charges come in the summer of 2023, and I was told that I would face a trial in the fall of 2023. And with those charges came some alleged evidence. And so I started writing my defense, thinking that I was going to present this to the jury. As I was writing, I knew for one thing that I wanted to make a case for full queer inclusion. And that was going to go well beyond any sort of debate about evidence here. So as you know from reading the book, that's kind of how I start. Kind of start with this general case for full inclusion. And then I move to address the particular evidence. But as I'm writing, and as this trial is not happening, you know, I'm not getting any word from anybody for like 9 months, I realized that really my audience wasn't the jury. I came to believe that I was going to lose this this trial because another guy named D. Kelly, who had written an essay for my book and had done far, far less than I had to advance things, queer issues, he was tried and convicted and went through appeals and he lost his ordination. So I was convinced there was no way I was going to make it through. So instead of thinking that my defense was really aimed at the jury, I decided my defense was really aimed at the general public. And that changed a little bit of the way I wrote the defense, but not a ton, because I kind of wanted to make my overall case for full queer inclusion. But to give you an idea of how that then affected me, even before the trial occurred, in fact, a month before, I published this book called My Defense on Amazon. So I'm putting everything out there before the trial is even there, because for me, my primary audience is the general church and the public at large, and not the people, the seven people at the trial.
So, Tom, as I understand it, you know, Church of the Nazarene is in the Wesleyan holiness tradition. Fairly, you know, none of these words are do all good work, but fairly conservative, based upon spectrums we typically use in nomenclature, colloquially, you know, that phrase. And so, in one way, in one sense, your teaching of inclusion and affirmation was a violation, right, of what the tradition, the denomination held to be true. So the result was essentially you were demembered and you no longer are able to teach or minister in the denomination. I think you framed it as you're kind of a heretic right now, right?
Well, that's the word they even used in the verdict, so yeah.
Yeah, and so help us understand then, there's a lot of listeners who are in similar denominations right now and maybe are just squeamish about the scapegoating of LGBTQ plus people. Maybe they have a traditional sexuality, but they're tired of those people bearing the weight of all our sins. There's other people who don't know where they stand, maybe. They maybe want to be inclusive, but feel constrained by exegesis or theology that it can't be. And then there's a third group of people who probably are like secretly open and affirming, but their wallets are tied to organizations, institutions, and churches that aren't. Help us understand the calculus you used to go from quietly affirming 20, 30 years ago to a belligerent advocate for inclusion. What was the calculus in your mind that helped you make that shift? Why did you do it?
Well, the first calculus occurred in the early 1990s after a class that I mentioned earlier. My question was, okay, if I'm going to think that the full affirmation approach is the best, then should I stay in a denomination that doesn't seem like it's anytime soon is going to change its mind on this? And I stayed for three basic reasons. One, I think the theological core of the Church of the Nazarene, which is a Wesleyan core, is a core that revolves around love. And so while the denomination wasn't an affirming place, I thought its theological message should bring it to that place. Secondly, I knew that if I ended up being a professor, I would likely be engaging lots of students, often in their early 20s, who are having questions about sexuality in general and their own sexuality in particular. And I thought that I might be a kind of voice and help students at that crucial time. And third, not long after I came to my view on things, I discovered others in the denomination, mostly scholars actually, who shared a similar view. And so I thought, well, maybe together we can move this very conservative denomination toward a full affirmation position. So then my strategy for the next couple of decades was to be more or less working behind the scenes. And as you mentioned, some of your listeners might be in that particular situation. And I want to say very clearly that although many times while I was doing that, I felt guilty I wasn't doing more and wasn't more public, I also felt like I was doing really important work as an insider. Mm-hmm. I remember watching a PBS special on an individual whose name I've forgotten, but during the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King and all that. And mm-hmm. this individual was working in Washington, D.C. with these senators trying to coax them toward a more welcoming position to folks of color, and had to do so behind the scenes. But that was really crucial in the civil rights movement. And I thought, yeah, there is a place for people to stay in a denomination and try to change things from the inside. And so that's what I did. Now, I'm not saying everybody ought to stay. Let me be clear about that, too. Some people need to walk away for whatever reasons. But for me, I felt like that was a role I could play. I could try to move things inside. But then in 2015, I lost my job as a theologian in the Church of the Nazarene at one of its institutions. And that kind of freed me up. I no longer felt like I was quite the insider that I was previously. And now I could be more, what'd you call it, belligerent? I could be more vocal. And that's what I started doing. I even though I was still a part of the denomination, I didn't hold an official position as a theologian from 2015 to the present. Mm-hmm. And so that was part of my calculus too. And then when I was a first CEO, this is actually the third trial I've been through. The 2015, I went through a theological trial and was not declared a heretic. In 2022, I went through a hearing that was like a trial, and that was over queer issues. And they didn't convict me at that time, basically because there weren't the mechanisms in the church's system to convict me. So at each stage, I'm strategically asking myself, given who I am and the situation I'm in right now, what would be the most loving, the most effective to bring about good in the world and in the denomination?
Yeah. Yeah. Coming back to that rubric of love again.
Right. Right.
Yeah. What, I wonder then, given your experience, I know there's denominations that have kind of fought these battles and had these discussions, and there have been splits. There's denominations that are, very recently, splitting over this. And I know of other denominations that are like, it's a real live question right now. Yeah. They're trying to sort it out, kind of where are we going to land on this? From your perspective and in your opinion, do you think there's any way for denominations to hold affirming and non-affirming positions together? Is there any way for people who find themselves on other opposite ends of that issue to like walk together long-term, in a denominational structure? Or do you think it's inevitable that split will happen?
I think it's possible, but not likely.
Okay.
I think it's possible to have a very general kind of doctrinal claim about the healthiness of human sexuality and then have people in the denomination have differing opinions about what that's like. Mm-hmm. What it will probably end up cashing out as is that the specific or individual churches will in such a denomination will make their claim about what they're going to affirm and not affirm as a church within the broader denomination. Mm-hmm. But it's very hard for any denomination or even any church, but especially a denomination to fully affirm both, we'll call it the non-affirming and the affirming views, to fully embrace both views. Yeah. The reason it's so hard is that folks who I'll call embrace the traditional view, many of them think this is a salvation, heaven or hell issue. I mean, if you look at some of the notes that I get, or even the verdict of my trial, I mean, it was right there in the verdict that they thought I'm leading people to hell, basically. They didn't use hell. They said only eternity will show how many people he has, you know, destroyed or deceived or whatever. Mm-hmm. So if you think that heaven and hell are on the line on this issue, you're not going to want to be a part of a denomination that, in your view, waffles on it. Yeah. In the more progressive side of things, you're also going to be pretty dissatisfied if the church doesn't come down strongly on an affirming position, because you're probably going to say, I know all these people who have been so hurt, so kicked out, so ostracized, so told that their orientation is inherently sinful or their behavior is immoral. And so if you're a fully affirming person, you're going to have a hard time staying in a waffle, this, I call it a waffling denomination. That's a negative term. This denomination that tries to have one general principle and let everyone else sort of play out the details. Yeah. So yeah, in theory, possible. In reality, not likely.
And now a word from a sponsor.
Black Friday is coming, and for the adults in your life who love the coolest toys, well, there's something for them this year, too. Bartesian is the premier craft cocktail maker that automatically makes more than 60 seasonal and classic cocktails, each in under 30 seconds at the push of a button. And right now, Bartesian is having a huge site-wide sale. You can get $100 off any cocktail maker or cocktail maker bundle when you spend $400 or more. So, if the cocktail lover in your life has been good this year, or the right kind of bad, get them Bartesian. At the push of a button, make bar-quality cosmopolitans, martinis, Manhattans, and more. All in just 30 seconds. All for 100 off. Amazing toys aren't just for kids. Get 100 off a cocktail maker when you spend 400 through Cyber Monday. Visit bartesian.com/cocktail. That's bartesian.com/cocktail.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
I was surprised in conversations about these issues. I remember feeling surprised that it was such a hot button issue. There's other issues that, I mean, you know, take baptism, for example, which is a lot more closely aligned with salvation, actually, in the theological sense of things. But we don't have any trouble sort of holding, we're fairly generous towards each other in our view of baptism. Say, if you believe in baptizing children or baptizing adults only, you know, that kind of a thing. What is it about this issue that makes it such a hot button issue? It sort of activates people's emotions, very, very strong emotions, very quickly. I found it a difficult topic to talk about because people, they get activated so quickly.
Yeah. Well, it's difficult because of three reasons: sex, sex, and sex. I mean,
hold on, let me write that down.
I mean, think about this. Sex is just such a powerful thing, not only in our culture, but, you know, in the church and in society. Look at the Christian scriptures. There is so much in there revolving around sexual issues. Not all of it negative, but sex is a really important and often talked about thing. Yeah. And I think it's one of the, if not the most emotionally laden activities or orientations we have. And a major part of that is what I call the aesthetics issue. So oftentimes in the discussion of queer issues, people who are Christians like me will start with the Bible, and then we'll sort of look at the relevant passages, and we might have different interpretations. Someone will say, well, you're just not reading the Bible correctly, and the other person will respond. But I find that more often it's the case that the Bible is not really what's motivating, especially the more traditional view. I find that what's a very strong motivator is what I like to call the yuck factor.
Yeah.
That is, I think many traditional people imagine queer sex and they're grossed out. It's aesthetically unpleasing. And that kind of emotional response is deep, super deep. Yeah. It's not something you just shed by, you know, quickly by just sort of saying, okay, well, maybe it's not so gross. So because of that, I think the rhetoric gets to be so charged because aesthetics really do matter.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's just something that I think part of the reason that's so powerful is that that's a gut level instinctual response from people that most people just have not examined to say like, well, where does that coming from? And so they just trust it. You know, it's like the Holy Spirit. It must be the Holy Spirit. You know, they're like, I've actually heard pastors talk about your disgust about these things is a sign that, you know, that God is speaking to you, that God, you know, clearly sees it this way and all that kind of thing. We just don't examine it as that, you know, that there is, and the fact that we can be conditioned to find things disgusting, right?
Right.
You know,
here's a good analogy.
Yeah, go ahead.
My wife likes to eat tuna fish sandwiches, and the smell of tuna fish just grosses me out. I ask her to step outside the house when she's going to eat tuna fish because it's gross. In the 30 plus years of our marriage, my gross barometer has not decreased any. It's still gross. But I can look at her and think she's valuable. I love her deeply. She's a wonderful person. And yet she has this strange attraction to tuna fish. Right. And so I can get along with her despite this thing. Yeah. I think that's what has to happen for many people when it comes to queer issues, especially those who have a high gross factor barometer. They have to realize I may never think it's not gross or it's not gross, but I'll have to come to the place by saying that it can be healthy, even though I personally get grossed out by thinking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's something. That's something that is worth exploring, you know, on a deeper level, because I like your analogy. I just made a dish the other day with fish sauce in it and was reminded afterwards that I don't actually like the smell of fish sauce. But I know there's whole food cultures, right, that where it's just, you know, the Thai foods, it's just like full of fish sauce and they love fish sauce you know, and all that kind of thing. And I was even thinking about this the other day. We were at this past summer and we were on vacation. We were at a soccer game and there were some people sitting in front of us who, I think they were probably like immigrants from Africa. And one of the things, that I know about a lot of, you know, African countries is like deodorant is not commonly used by men. Yeah. And there was these men sitting in front of us and the smell of body odor, I was like, oh, this is like, it's grossing me out.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about like, well, it obviously is not grossing them out. And probably for most of us before men started wearing deodorant, I don't know, what was it, the 60s they started wearing deodorant? Like even in here in America, it was like, we were just used to the smell of body odor.
Yeah. Anyway,
it's probably a side issue, but I think there's something to it that, that's worth examining. And I like your example of, you don't necessarily need to moralize your wife's love of tuna fish. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
One of you isn't right and the other one wrong to like it, you know?
And I may never get over it. I think that's another thing.
Right. Yeah. I think that's there's some grace in that too. So,
Tom, if I may suggest holding a trial where you bring your wife up on charges.
make sure you have the structural denominational structures
culinary
in place
malfeasance.
Excommunicator.
Oh man. I love it.
So Tom, where are you at now? You've been your childhood tether to this denomination has been cut. Where do you go now? How are you doing with all that? How are you feeling?
Well, I'm feeling weird is what I'm feeling, you know, because as you mentioned, this group has been one of my core identities for the last 50 plus years. Mm. And I don't plan to join another denomination, at least not in the short run. Maybe eventually I will. I'm still trying to follow Jesus, still trying to live a life of love, still write theology books and help people think about God. But I don't plan to quickly join another group. It's the case that the little church that I attend, which is a Church of the Nazarene congregation, many of the people there are affirming. And so, and my wife is on the church board. So at least in the short run, we can plan to continue attending that little church. But, you know, who knows what's going to happen in the long run.
Yeah. Yeah, this does feel like something that most churches and denominations will have to reckon with, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of our listeners have asked us to do a series on this. Yeah. And there's so much crammed into an LGBTQ conversation, history, culture, exegesis, et cetera, that it feels unruly to get after it. But I do appreciate you joining us today, sharing a bit about your journey. And I wonder, maybe as we wrap up, do you ever counsel people who want to look into this or take some time to study? And if you do, what are some things maybe you would say if somebody said, hey, I want to reevaluate, or I want to make sure that what I've been taught is true? Where would you encourage them to start?
I think I would start by saying that there are really good people on both sides of this issue and really jerks on both sides of this issue. It's easy for us as individuals who maybe take one side or the other to see only jerks in the other side and not in our side, but there are some jerks in our side. And I think there's also people with really good hearts and good intentions who can have differing views on us when it comes to queer matters. Now, just because there's good people on the other side doesn't mean that one stance is just as good as another. I'm just saying, you know, don't demonize your conversation partners.
Yeah.
If you come from a more conservative Christian tradition like me, I think working through the issues of Scripture is really important. And that's, you know, a pretty daunting task. For me, working through those issues helped me to realize that love is my ultimate hermeneutic, which is another way of saying I want to interpret the Bible through the lens of love, and that then shapes how I come to think about queer issues. But if you're from that kind of a background, I encourage you to read biblical scholars. Amy Jill Levine is a good one. There's lots of books out there. One of my favorites is by David Gushee called Changing Our Minds. I think it's a good sort of starter book for people to wrestle through these things. So I don't know. Those would be some of the tips I'd have.
Yeah. It's helpful.
It is helpful. Tom, if people are interested in learning more about you, finding you, even, you know, I know right now you oversee a doctoral program. Is that right?
Yeah.
Where can they find out about your work and your writing, et cetera?
Well, the doctoral program is in open and relational theology through Northwind Theological Seminary. And what makes it, one of the things that makes it unique is it's a fully online doctoral program that follows the Oxford method, which means that I work one-on-one with my doctoral students going through issues and topics that they want to explore. I also run a Center for Open and Relational Theology. You can Google that and find out more information on that. And I have a personal website that's my full name, thomasjor.com.
Okay. Well, we'll have you back on. I'd love to explore more open and relational theology and how love fits into that. Maybe we can do that here in a few months. But Tom, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us today.
Yeah, it's been great talking with you guys.
You know what I'm thinking about, Ben?
No, I don't.
All right. Well,
by definition, I can't know it.
Well, I'll tell you.
Because that's how thoughts work.
Anyway, listen up.
What are you going to say?
One of the things that we have touched on hither and thither on this podcast is LGBTQ issues. You know, we had, I just spaced on her name.
Me too. I know who you're talking about.
Oh my gosh. She was like right there and now she's gone. This makes for great radio. This makes for excellent radio.
Listener, understand, we will not go back and re-record this. This is you are hearing this. This is how we do it.
Out of a plane. I'm going to look. Forgot the parachute. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this in the past, but we haven't scheduled or produced a series on it for several reasons. Mm-hmm. Number one, LGBTQ plus issues, probably more than ever now in 2024, are such a powder keg. Yeah, you know, denominations are splitting over it. People are losing jobs over it. Richard Hayes, his son, who teaches at Fuller, they're world-renowned New Testament scholars, are releasing a book on how they changed their mind on LGBTQ+. Yeah. And people are going bonkers about it. And I've wanted to do it in a way that is non-anxious, meaning where it's not a heretical or orthodox issue, and respecting people. But also, Ben, it's not an issue for gay people. It actually is like they take it personally. It's about them personally, right?
Well, yeah, because it is.
It is personal.
It is, yeah. They're not taking something personally that they need not take personally.
No. It is personal. Yeah. And so this is just a confession, listener. I haven't known how to reframe a conversation away from like a culture war powder keg to something that's non-anxious or respect each other and treat LGBTQ people with dignity and respect.
Right. Instead of, I think the default can be to sort of, treat them as if they're not listening. They're not in the room, you know? And if you're going to podcast, they're in the room, you know, like they're here, you know?
And that, one of the benefits of being a white cisgendered man is that I never have to be in a room where somebody speaks about my identity and my person, my body as though it's illegitimate. Mm-hmm. Right? And we see actually in some places now where white cisgendered men are not being centered, or they aren't automatically listened to, and how white men freak out about that.
Yeah.
Like just can't handle it. Right. We can't handle it. Yeah. And when people freak out about quote being canceled, or, you know, Jordan Peterson talks about how you can't persecuted. We're persecuted. All I think is this is how LGBTQ people feel all the time. First of all, secondly, just because you're not centered or given the privilege of having the norm ordinary perspective, just because you aren't honored as supreme doesn't mean you're being persecuted. So I don't want to equate the way that white men are being decentered with how LGBTQ people are being marginalized.
No.
I'm not trying to equate those. What I'm saying is I don't want to have a conversation where we speak about quote an issue that is more than an issue. It's about people. Mm-hmm. It's about real people. And I don't want to treat it as though they're like we're talking about them in the room, or, you know, that there's nothing at stake for them in this conversation, because there is, right?
Right. Yeah. It's not a purely academic, you know, sort of no stakes conversation. There's really a lot at stake. So there's a lot to navigate, is kind of what you're saying. And that's the reason we haven't had the time or wherewithal to think through all of how to do that well.
Yeah. I mean, it's really like the wisdom, you know? Because I don't want to, you know, I cause plenty of harm, and I realize that this is like a minefield where I could cause harm without knowing it, and then the benefit wouldn't be requisite to the harm, you know. And so I just don't want to cause harm. So anyway, that's why we haven't done it yet. But you know what? Screw it, Ben. Let's just go. Let's go for it.
Okay.
That's, you know, I think that's what wisdom says. I think that's in Proverbs.
Screw it. Let's go for it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's Ecclesiastes, actually. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think
You know what? None of this matters. Just have a good time. I think that's Ecclesiastes in a nutshell.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Tangentially, I do love Ecclesiastes came up in the Daily Office a few months ago, and I do just love that that's in the Bible.
Yeah, man. The
book makes me laugh out loud, some of the stuff that's in there. It's just like, anyway.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, this is in the Bible. You know, a guy right. who had everything and was like, you know what? None of this matters. This sucks. Life's empty. Amen. The word of the Lord. Anyway.
Ben, did you know what you should do if you're addicted to seaweed?
No.
Seek help.
Seek help. I'll keep it in mind.
Okay.
Okay.
Just all right, listener. Pro tip.
Keep that in mind, all you listeners out there as well.
All right.
See you next time, everybody.
Bye-bye. Peace.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity Commons. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sturkey and Matt Tebby. Aaron Sturkey edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsturkey.com. We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or a comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
Black Friday is coming, and for the adults in your life who love the coolest toys, well, there's something for them this year, too. Bartesian is the premier craft cocktail maker that automatically makes more than 60 seasonal and classic cocktails, each in under 30 seconds at the push of a button. And right now, Bartesian is having a huge site-wide sale. You can get $100 off any cocktail maker or cocktail maker bundle when you spend $400 or more. So, if the cocktail lover in your life has been good this year, or the right kind of bad, get them Bartesian. At the push of a button, make bar-quality cosmopolitans, martinis, Manhattans, and more. All in just 30 seconds. All for 100 off. Amazing toys aren't just for kids. Get 100 off a cocktail maker when you spend 400 through Cyber Monday. Visit bartesian.com/cocktail. That's bartesian.com/cocktail.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. And now during our Black Friday sale, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed. Plus special financing. Limited time. To find a store near you, visit sleepnumber.com.